Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
"It's time to switch."
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA, what you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply.
My aunt, an aunt of mine, my mother's sister, gave me for Christmas a little transistor radio, red, sort of cranberry red radio. I can see it now with my eyes wide open. and that, listening to this radio late at night when I should have been asleep, my grandmother shouting at me, "Turn that thing off and go to sleep. You know, you got school first thing in the morning." That kind of business was going on. And I would, this little radio was my, it was my periscope, if you will, to the outside world. Everything came in through that radio, and in my dreams, everything went out, back out through this radio, because it shone a light on what was possible. For 1 hour, Steve, for 1 hour on any given night around 11 o'clock, in Florida, 11 o'clock at night, you're able to tune into this one station, and for that 1 hour, they played R&B music. They played a mixture of gospel and R&B and so forth. And it was my, I knew what I wanted to be from that moment. So yeah, it was my escape. It was my route out. It was the cannon that shot me out like a cannonball.
Jimmy, first of all, oh my God, just seeing you there brings back so many wonderful memories for me. And this is an absolute pleasure to see you again and to talk to you. So thank you for making the time. You have a fascinating, incredible life. And I don't know, I've been doing the research to this, and I wish I knew all that I know now about you. I wish I knew it back then to really be able to appreciate what you've lived in your life. And that it's just amazing. Now, one of the most, it was one of the most fascinating things for me to find out that you are a Seminole, as it's called, maybe you should tell me what it is actually. You were born in Florida to a father who was a Seminole preacher. Can you explain what Seminole is?
Okay, the Seminoles was an Indian tribe, still is, who I think originated a little bit up in the north of the eastern side of the United States, from Georgia and that area of the U.S. During the time of slavery, black slavery in America, there were bonds that were struck between local Indian tribes and the black community, escaped slaves who were trying to gain their freedom and find some protection in that freedom. And so there was a big, historically, there's a huge association between Indian tribes in America and black people, especially from that period when all the oppression that was going on with Indians in America, the Native American Indians and black people, they sort of found a common ground to help to save each other, if you will. So that is the basis of the association by which my grandfather, who was in fact black Seminole, Seminoles and blacks, integrated, married, and offspring, so forth. So my grandfather would have been called a black Seminole Indian.
So tell me about the community itself, because in Florida there was a large grouping of Seminoles, and I read that in earlier times when the Spanish were fighting the U.S., they incorporated in a sense the Seminole community. Only to help them fight, I presume. History is so awful when you read about it.
They had a common cause.
Had a common cause, and also they had then a common religion, because the Seminoles were then Catholic, or they entered the Catholic religion because of that, I think. Yes. So can you tell me about what it was like growing up in that community? What it was about? What was different about it, in sort of my terms? What would have been different?
It was a very small community, very close-knit community. We were a black family. There were very few black families in this town where I was born and raised. So we were very sort of isolated in that sense of the word. My memories of childhood were, you did your work, you went to school, you did your things, but it was a very insulated community because there was a lot of not so nice business going on around in terms of violence and so forth. We heard stories. I had incidents within my own family of people being abused, mistreated, and so forth. I experienced it myself. Knock wood, I survived it. But the fact of survival is something that it's a healing process that never ends. So in a capsule, yes, I was in this situation, which I was very anxious to get out of from a very early age, if you can imagine. And so I was doing everything I could to try and expedite that process to get out as quick as I could. Family and everything, with all due respect to that, it really was a sense of, to survive, you're going to have to get out of here. And that was my motivation.
It was also...
I was out there like a cannon shot, Boom! I was gone. First chance I got.
It was a matriarchal society, wasn't it? That's what I read today. That it was a matriarchal society, and that you were born into the clan of the mother.
Yes.
Do you know what clan you were?
Oh, we. Well, no, not so much. I mean, in hindsight, I gather more than I ever knew, obviously, while I was there in that experience. Hindsight has taught me many, many lessons, life lessons, if you will, that came from that experience. But in terms of clans and so forth, we were just sticking together the best we could. If there was a clan, it was in the church. My grandfather was a preacher. We were in church sort of 6-7 days a week or nights a week, and some sort of church function going on. And that was, as historical is the case with most people of that time, of my color, of my race, we were, the church was the saving ground. That was the safe place to be. So when later on you had these stories about churches being burned and bombed and so forth, it was a direct hit on the clan, if you will. That was the sacred place where anybody thought they could gather together, feel protected, feel as though they were protecting each other to get beyond this situation. Yeah. So,
I mean, you mentioned that you were in church a number of evenings a week, or five times a week or something like that. I presume this was also a church where there was gospel music, or where there was music, and a church where there was singing, I'm just imagining this in my head. Is that correct? And that's also a place, obviously, where you could express yourself?
Absolutely. Anybody who had anything to say about their daily life or daily experiences, good, bad, indifferent, that was an opportunity to do that in church. You could stand up and say, oh, this happened to me yesterday at school, and I want to talk about it because I have it's left scars or whatever.
But was there singing in church?
Absolutely.
Could you tell me about that?
Okay. In those days, gospel music was such an integral part, of course, of being in church. There were gospel groups coming around. Rosetta Tharpe names. If you go back and have a look, you'll see these names as being the foundation of gospel music as we know it. Rosetta Tharpe, harmony groups like the Five Blind Boys, and all of these groups who were coming through to help knit this the community together, were arriving at our church. And on any given Sunday in our church, we'd have any one of maybe two or three of these groups standing up to perform with us for us, with a guitar, maybe a little amplifier, and five amazing voices singing harmony. That's where that's the root of my dreams about singing from the very beginning.
Did you actually perform there as well, though? Did you actually, in a group in the gospel choir or whatever, did you actually perform there in front of people? Was that the first time for you to perform?
We braved it, and a couple of cousins and I decided that we're going to get up in the church on the following Sunday and sing a couple of songs. Yeah, and so we would listen to the radio, because that was our only outlet, really, to what was going on in the musical world, gospel or otherwise. So we'd get in the corners at school or wherever and get a little harmony thing going. Do bo do bo bo be do bo do bo do bo do bo be do, and these things, that music is rooted in gospel. That whole concept of doo-wop music is rooted in gospel. And that's what we picked up on at a very early age. And I was able to stand up in the confidence of my cousins. We braved each other up, so to speak. And we'd get up on Sunday, and every opportunity we got, we'd get up and sing. And that was how it began, that's how we started.
Music provides an escape for a lot of people in their youth. I mean, your situation is a lot different to when I was brought up, but music provided a massive escape to me as someone who sort of wanted to just get away from my childhood, wanted to get away from what I felt my situation was back then. I look at it differently today, obviously. And it was a wonderful escape. So was this radio, in effect, the means to escape your own situation in your own world in the beginning?
It was like, it was like Alice Through the Looking Glass, or if you want to call it. It was my,
I mean, there were other things that happened before you actually left, but you also learned to play the trumpet, didn't you? How did that come about?
Very quickly, my cousin, my girl cousin, just a few years older than I, arrived back from school one day, got off the school bus with this little case in her hand, and I said, "What's that?" She opened it up, and it was like, woof, excuse my expression, it was like opening up a coffin, because the inside of this case was like the kind of material that you should see inside of a coffin. And I jumped back for a second, and go, "Oh, I'm not sure I want to touch this thing. What is it?" It was a cornet, which a smaller version of a trumpet, if you will. And she had picked it up at school bandmaster told her, yes, you can learn to play this instrument. If any of your cousins or so forth would like to come in and have a look, we can get them into the music system in the school. So that was my beginning. I was hooked. I went into the band room the next day and arrived back home with this case. My grandmother, I took it out in the backyard and started making this terrible noise with it, of course. And my grandmother said, you will take that thing back tomorrow and not bring it back again. It's too much noise. You know, Mama, Grandma, I'm going to play it outside. It's okay. Don't worry. No, no. And I think, if anything, Steve, it gave me a sense of motivation. It gave me my grandmother telling me, you can't do that, was my motivation to prove that I was going to do it and it was going to be something that I hung on to. So in that sense of the word, in hindsight, once again, it was a wonderful moment for me because I proved something to myself and I think maybe to my grandmother that, yeah, if you want something and you stay with it, then you'll gain some respect for doing that. So
How much pressure did you have on you to have an education and actually not just sort of go straight in like a cannonball into the world of music?
Oh, it was total. It was not a case of this is what I want to do. And, you know, sod school, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do music. It didn't work that way. I had to adhere to the fact that my parents were raising me and I had to adhere to the policies, you know, the rules, the ground rules. It said, you'll finish high school, you'll go to college, your university, and you'll get some professional, education under your belt. And then if you decide that after that you want to go and risk having some sort of a musical thing as a sideline, then fine. But first thing you're going to do is get yourself a good education because that's what's going to see you through this world. So I had to do that. I stayed at university for a couple of years, reached a point when I said, I ain't going to do this no more. and I stopped doing it. I went on the road with a band. So at least I made the effort to adhere to my folks' wishes in terms of an education. And I got that under my belt and I'm glad for that.
So tell me about this period that you went on tour with a band, because if it was your first band, what were you doing in the band? And also where did you go and what was the reaction to that band?
Okay, this band formed in Columbus, Ohio. That's where I finished high school and a couple of years of university. I hooked up with some local guys who were traveling a lot. One guy had a band. He had traveled a lot around the East Coast of America, up into Canada, etc. And he said to me, I hear you singing and I hear you playing a little bit of trumpet and come down and let's talk about maybe joining the band. This guy had a local reputation of, some degree of success, you know, so that was an opportunity. I went down, we talked, he came over to my house, we talked, we drove around in the car, went for hamburgers and things, you know, French fries, all of that, and ended up with me joining the band. The first, I think the first traveling we did was up to Boston, then up to Canada, traveling around up and down that side of the East Coast of America. And that was my introduction. One sweet story for me, my memory tells me that most of the time in that first band, I was the guy standing in the background playing the trumpet. And the guy or the lady, whatever, was out front on the microphone singing, was the one who was getting all the attention. You know what I mean? So I went, whoa, maybe I should like sort of nudge myself to the front of this band and so and get my hands on the microphone. So it's interesting because maybe not the best analogy, but when I see now photographs of Jimi Hendrix when he was playing guitar way in the back for the Isley Brothers and with Little Richard and all of these guys, you think, well, what would not have happened if he'd stayed back there being satisfied with being the guy back in the shadows in the background with somebody else out front doing the business, you know? So yeah, it was a moment of great revelation for me, that first opportunity on the road, because I got to see what was capable, what was possible, and built some confidence as a result. Wonderful.
It was also in an era of pre-civil rights, or around that period where civil rights were being finally talked about, and it must have been difficult being on the road. And I can't imagine, obviously, how you must have been treated sometimes, or how it must have been as a Black person in that period. So along with these sort of wonderful highlights and a wonderful process, I imagine there's also a sort of painful memory attached to it as well. Could you tell me a little bit about what it was like back then?
I can give you a for instance, Steve. I remember an occasion when I was just, I think, still at university, still trying to find my feet in doing music for real, for a career. And we'd driven a car, we got in a car, five of us. We were looking for a record deal. We were trying to get signed to a record company. Cincinnati, Ohio was the home of a record label called King Records. King Records had at that time James Brown and the Famous Flames. That was before James Brown became the James Brown that we associate his name with now and his face with now. We'd driven up to Cincinnati, had a meeting with this some people in this record company, King Records, and we were waiting for an outcome. Few days, we got no reply from our audition, if you will. The audition, by the way, was just a simple version of standing at reception at King Records, just boring the hell out of the receptionist, singing one song after another, all that business, you know, until she said, okay, you can go in and see the A&R guy, fine, just leave me alone, you know, that kind of vibe. Anyway, a quick aside, but the point was that we did this audition, if you will, and got no reply. We're sitting around, we're sleeping in the car, basically waiting for some kind of word back to say yeah, come back, or no, forget it, whatever. And so while we're waiting, what happens? We're sleeping in the car. The driver of the car, we call him Big Boy because that was his nickname. He was not such a great singer, but he had a car, you know? So that's why he was in the band in the first place. So Big Boy took it upon himself to go out looking for something we knew nothing about until he arrived back and said, hey guys, we got a flat tire, and I went to try and find a tire, but I didn't find one. We got a problem. About 15 minutes later, while we're scratching our heads, wondering what we're going to do about this situation we're in, a man arrives, a redneck, if you will, with a gun. And we look up, and this guy has got the gun that just resting on the windscreen of our car, saying, everybody out of the car. Obviously, our man Big Boy had tried to nick a tire because we had no money, to nick a tire so we could get a spare onto the car and get out as quick as we could. The long and short of the story was we all wound up before the local police trying to get some well, trying to make some sense out of this situation, because four out of the five of us knew nothing about this thing having happened in the first place. But the fact that this man saw no other recourse than to arrive at our car, and we're sleeping, and put aim his, the barrel of his gun at the windscreen of our car and say, well, I make a citizen's arrest. You're all under arrest for trying to steal from my my junkyard or whatever it was, you know. So that kind of situation was not, it was sad news, but not big news. The kind of thing that occurred quite often. So, yeah.
Tell me about when you recorded your first, when you actually recorded your first track. I think it was Susie's Gone, wasn't it?
Yes.
Now, I listened to that today. I tell you what struck me about it, which is really interesting. It was almost like a misuse of your voice, because your voice has this amazing, wonderful tonal quality. And then this explosion of voice can come out, you know, like it has such an amazing depth and such a range. And thank that you. Song sort of didn't use that range. It was like, was it something that was just, you know, given to you, you're going to sing this. This is going to be your first record.
Pretty much. You pretty much nailed it. It was for a naive guy like me, just trying to find his feet and have a career. you grabbed at whatever straws you could. In hindsight, you make mistakes. You make bad decisions about the songs that you choose. And I was always hoping and praying to get myself in a position where I could write songs to alleviate that pressure of where's the song going to come from, you know? Once again, it was the part of my career that I look back on now in hindsight and wish that I'd earlier on gotten my hands on a piano or guitar or something. I chose the trumpet. A trumpet is not a song for an instrument for writing songs. It is what it is. It's a brass instrument. And in hindsight, I would have learned the piano, enough basic chords, etc., to be able to express myself, put chords together, write songs, and get that together. That didn't come to much later.
Yeah, you say that, but that Jimmy Radcliffe song that you recorded, You're Mine, You Are Mine, this one, I mean, that really expresses, you know, it shows the power of your voice. And I listened to that this morning and I was thinking, wow, that is a great song. So I think there are, you know, like you say it as sort of mistakes. I think there are only experiences in life, not really mistakes that take you on some form of a journey. And that song, I thought that song was wonderful. And it really, showed the potential of your voice.
Well, thank you, Steve, and especially for pointing out the fact, and it is a fact, there's no such thing as a mistake. It's what you do after it. It's what you do after that thing that you didn't feel so good about. That's the important thing. Miles Davis put it very well. He said, there's no such thing as a bad note. It's only the note that you play after it, you know, that corrects itself and makes what you did before sound great, because it's there's cohesion, so forth. So you're right. You're right about that. Thank you.
The 60s seemed to be an era where you were finding yourself musically and finding your sort of route through this world, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you joined up, and I hope I get the name right, with Carl Sally, who was a famous saxophonist and had a band. I presume then you were the trumpeter in that band, or a trumpeter correct. In that band. Can you tell me about that experience and what it gave you as a performer to be in something like that?
Well, Carl Sally's band was, in fact, the band that I traveled from Columbus, Ohio, up to Boston and into Canada with. And we did gigs around New York. We played some, at the time, pretty famous venues in New York City. There was a place called Small's Paradise, which is had begun like a kind of a place with big R&B reviews, big chorus line of dancers, etc. But they'd also do things like small jazz quartets and the kind of music that we were doing with Carl Sally, which was covers of R&B stuff, a little bit of the commercial side of jazz. And there I was, as I was saying to you before, I was playing the trumpet mainly. We had two lady singers out front. And it was at that particular point in time that I pulled the two ladies aside one night and said, "Hey, look, we need to do something together because, you know, I got this idea for some vocals and we can share and we can duet and blah, 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 blah," and so forth. And that was a very crucial time for me because it was me moving out of being noted as a trumpet player in the back to a guy who could come up front and grab the microphone and sing a few tunes as well. So that was crucial for me. It was a crossroads. Yeah.
How was that first experience then? You know, you say these two ladies, you talked to them and said, "Hey, you know, I should be there too, or I can do that too, and we should do something together." I mean, you know, people aren't always that open. They're sort of like saying, "Well, hang on a minute, this is my area. Keep out." Yeah. You know, I don't know how it goes. So was it a case of they were very open about it and allowed you, or did you really have to sort of push your way in? And how was the reaction, you know, on the first time that you performed in front of an audience with them?
Okay, for a start, I was scared right out of my pants for trying coming up with this kind of, you're sticking your neck out a yard here, you know, by you're subject to get kicked out the band, and that's not such a convenient thing if you're that few thousand miles away from home. So it was courage. I was scared to do it, but I knew I had to. In the same way that I knew I had to hang on to that trumpet when Grandma said, "You can't do that no more." And this, it was the same kind of feeling that if you don't do it now, you're never gonna. And that's what pushed me to the front of the bandstand. That's what made me, gave me the impetus to do it. And once I had done it, once I made that step, and showed that I was qualified. I was getting the result from the audience, getting kind of response from the audience that the band had maybe lacked a bit of before. Then some light started to come on, and it changed my life. It changed the life of the band. The duration of the rest of the time I was in this band, we got better shows, we got better venues to play, and so it kind of proved itself. And that's, wow, that was a big step for me.
Now, we mentioned the 60s with civil rights, mentioned your sort of journey through the 60s, as it were. Mm-hmm. The 60s was also an era of new sexual freedoms, of openness. It had the Vietnam War. I mean, yep. it was a very mixed bag of everything. Woo. The 60s in some way. And you were in a musical that essentially defines that era. And I, you know, and that was Hair. Can you tell me about the role you played in that musical and about being in that musical at that time? Because it caused such a reaction when it came out, didn't it? There was a movement against Hair, and it also inspired a movement against Vietnam. You know, Aquarius was a song that became an anthem against Vietnam in some ways.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, okay, to paint the backstory, a bit of backstory to my arriving in Hair, I had been 2 years in the U.S. military. I was 2 years in the American Army, and drafted, fought to stay out, didn't succeed, went in, did my bit for 2 years, came out, and tried to get some traction back in my musical career. I had been fortunate enough in the Army to play in the Army band in Atlanta, Georgia, which is a wonderful place to be. The musical atmosphere in Atlanta, Georgia at that time was just electric. So because of the civil rights movement, because of these things, and in spite of a lot of discouragement and so forth. So that was the kind of atmosphere at under which I arrived back in Boston after being in the military to try and find my career again, get it back and move on. And I had worked around the clubs and venues around Boston, New York City, so forth, did some television and got wind of auditions coming up for this musical, Hair. You know, at that point in time, the music from Hair was already kind of global, you know, Let the Sun Shine, all this music was already widely popular. And so the Boston production of Hair was the one that I was auditioning for, but I did the audition in New York City because I was there working in clubs, etc. Past the first, second audition, they said, okay, we may have a part for you in the Boston production as the black lead in the show. So, okay, thank you. I know Boston well. So, and I had a bit of an audience there from my previous days, my career up to that point. So it was with a lot of the feelings that I had being in the military, the things that were going on while I was in the military, the whole Vietnam situation, everything was going on at that point. And also at that point in time was Woodstock. All of this, all, wow, what an explosive, electrifying time to be alive, you know, and there I was right in the middle of all of this cultural upheaval, if you will, and having gotten this role, which defined in its way, it was groundbreaking sort of show in its time here. So wow, I can't express what it meant to me to achieve that role and to stay with that show for 2 years. It was one of the wonderful things in my life.
So tell me what it was like being the president of the United States of Love, which was the character of Hud.
it was interesting because if you saw production of Hair in London, or you saw a production in New York, San Francisco, wherever the show played, and it played most major cities around the world, Sydney, Australia, everywhere. Every one of the lead characters certainly had a different approach to how they played the character. And that's what made it interesting. The lead character for Hud, character I've heard in Boston, I got the opportunity, kind of an open ticket, to fly to all the other productions around and have a look and research what my character was doing in other productions of the show. So my character, I don't think I've ever come across as this tough, mean, badass guy. I mean, it's never been my persona, but it's amazing what happens to you when you start to draw on your childhood, when you start to draw on your life experiences up to that point and what's going on in the world around you at that point in time. And it made me, it brought out some meanness that I hadn't realized that I had. And it was very important to show that dark side because that's what the character is about. He's many things, Hud. He's many things to many people. So I got to see this whole prism of what this character was and how I could bring my own life experience to it, which is what made it everything to me. It was wonderful.
Tell me how you entered the stage. You remember?
I came out, I think the first featured number for Hud is he flies out onto the stage from the darkness, and he's sort of slides in on his knees like the footballers do when they've just scored a goal. Yeah! I mean, and he sings this song, his introductional piece of music. Good Lord, I hope I can remember the melody. I can't right now. But in so many words, he's saying, I'm here to tell you, I'm mirroring what you are and what we all are, and this is what the world is now, and all the badassness in the world is represented right here on this stage, and I'm your boy for that. You know, that's basically what he was saying.
I mean, isn't it brilliant as well to look at that and say, you know, this is the lead black character in, you know, a world-class, amazing production, and there you're coming on stage saying, I'm here. There's also, you know, that has a power in itself in that. As
absolutely,
well,
it's this character is mirroring what's going on in the world in racial terms, in political terms, in all kinds of social behavioral terms. He's just saying, this is what you think I am. This is what I think you are. And this is where we got big problems as a society, you know, and you can take that any way you want, you know, kind of vibe. Yeah, and it was a wonderful feeling.
How did the attention of that role then help your further musical music career?
Good question. There was a scene in Hair where it's a very symbolic scene. There's a lot of this.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The show was a symbolic scene where the American flag is placed on the floor of the stage. On the ground, and this is a big no-no in American society. You don't do that. We had the show was shut down for I think 2 weeks because of this move. The local councilors and politicians were up in arms, saying, "You could go to jail. You could go to prison for doing this. We're going to shut the show down and decide what's going to happen at that point." Well, it was a mixed blessing because I, at that point, I got a chance to do television in New York. There was a nationwide program called The Merv Griffin Show, which asked me to come back because I'd done this show quite a few times before. I came back on The Merv Griffin Show and talked about this incident in Boston that most other cities had overcome with their local politicians, and it wasn't a problem anymore. But Boston, being the conservative kind of town that it was, and in many ways still is, this issue of the flag on the floor was a big deal. So I went on the Merv Griffin Show, sang a couple of songs, went back again and again and again, and it started to give me more and more profile in America because this was a liftoff. And so, as I say, it was a mixed blessing in that sense of the word.
At Sleep Outfitters Outlet, great sleep is a big deal. Save 40 to 60% every day on every Sealy, Stearns & Foster, and Tempur-Pedic. queens as low as $249. Customer exchanges, closeouts, and floor samples. Inventory changes daily, so come in for your dream deal today. With no credit needed financing, expert advice, and up to 60% off retail, it's never been easier to get the sleep and savings you deserve. Go to sleepoutfittersoutlet.com for financing details and to find a store near you.
So how did that turn into sort of suddenly having the UK on your radar? Because if the 60s were, you know, this whole process that you went through, and then a sort of the bit of the catapult at the end because of Hair, and then came a decade where the UK sort of became more important. So how did that turn into actual record? And then how did that turn into coming to the UK?
Okay, my time in Hair was coming to an end. I had, as I say, this exposure at my fingertips with the Merv Griffin Show and a couple of other television shows in New York City. I went to New York again to work in the venues and gig around Manhattan. In that point in time, I hooked up. And we formed a band. It was originally formed in Boston. And we were working on the East Side in Manhattan for Yonks. People would come in to see us, and we got made a lot of progress from this venue that we were working in. One of the things that happened there was, record promoter, somebody I was speaking to in between our shows in this venue, said to me, "You know, there's an opportunity you may be interested in to go and do represent the U.S. in a song contest happening in Athens." So, thought about it, spoke to the band, said, I'll go and do this thing. We'll pick up where we left off later on. You know, we each had our opportunities, and we chased down our opportunities, such as life. So I went to Athens. The long and short of that is that I met Les Reed. Les Reed was one of the judges on the festival, on this Athens Song Festival. And of course, Les had written all of the big hits for Tom Jones. Les Reed approached me after the festival was finished and said, "Come to London. I think I may have some songs for you. Or if I don't, I know somebody who does. And I think we can find, if you're up to it, we can find some common ground here and maybe get some recording done." Okay. So I went, I finished. See how life is like a it's like watching a tennis match. The opportunities flying back and forth, and the ones that you're able to grasp as they fly past you are the ones that will either move you on or not. So I made the decision, and it turned out to be a good one, to save my pennies, get on the first flight I could with my saved pennies, and get to London. There I met, through Les Reed, I met John Worth, and bless him, he was a wonderful man. He had a spirit like Barry Gordy or somebody, you know. That's where he was in his mind. I think he wanted that kind of degree of, sure, recognition, but he wanted to achieve that kind of stature in the music business where, yeah, he wanted to produce, write songs and so forth. And it was the right person for me to meet in the right place at the right time. So it was one of those occasions. John Worth was a pivotal point in my career.
He'd written songs for Marty Wilde, for Adam Faith. I mean, he'd written by the time he wrote for you, he'd written for a number of very, very, very well-known stars of that era. Can you remember the first time you heard, and I'm not going to say the name of the track because I want you to say it, that you heard that track? you know, that or you saw the music, or he, I don't know how it would have worked. Would he have played it to you and said, this is a song I want to sing, you to sing?
If we're thinking about going to make you an offer you can't refuse, is that the one?
That's it.
Yeah, okay. The film, The Godfather, was big news. Of course, it was a big deal everywhere, globally. John Wirth had seen the film. I hadn't seen it yet. And so when he brought this idea to me, it was like, okay, you know, the vibe. He had seen the film, and this line kept sticking in his mind, I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. And we met the first time about this idea at the... At the recording company, which turned out to be Fly Records, Cube Records, and we routined this song with a new face, a new guy named Mike Moran. Mike Moran went on and did big work with Freddie Mercury, Barcelona, all of that, amongst his other successes. He was involved with heavily involved with Dave Clark's musical Time in the West End of London. So we routined the song and routined it and kicked it around. And it was just kind of nice melody, but not really, there was no peaks and valleys. There was not enough. You were speaking about it before. It had that all of that business, the melody down in the low range of my voice. But I'm thinking, well, where can it go to? Where's the ladder up, you know? And so Mike and I were sitting around the piano one day, and I came up with that falsetto bit and the little monologue after the chorus. Did you ever sit waiting, hoping, da ba 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 ba? And we molded this song out of a phrase, gonna make you an offer you can't refuse, but turning it into a love song. And finally, it became the song that people heard on the radio, and the rest is history.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, for me, I remember when that came out in the 70s. I would have been a teenager back then. And for me, it was that the beauty of the vocals on that song, which just sort of, I don't know, they shot up into the stratosphere, didn't they? They were just amazing. And it was a beautiful song. And as you say, it was a phrase that came from The Godfather, but it was an unexpected twist that also, I think, helped propel it, because people knew that phrase, but then they heard it as a love song, as you said. So in some way, you turned it into something very special.
It was one of those moments, and there have been a few, knock wood, and thankfully, a few moments when I can look at that incident and say, it was an inspired moment. I say inspired from whichever way you want to look at it. It was inspired that John Wirth came up with that phrase, came up with that melody. It was inspired that we three, Mike Moran, John and I, got together in the first place and came up with something that held water well enough that this far along afterwards, I can look at that and say, yeah, I'm proud of that moment. So thankfully, the gods were smiling.
After that, and it seems a real shame that in a way, you weren't able to capitalize on that enormous success of that song to have, you know, a further string of hits. And you went into a period of being a session musician, of working with other acts for quite a while. And I want to sort of bring this up to more about the time that we met before, so bringing it up further. And then suddenly, and I don't know how it came about because my memory's completely gone on this one, but you formed a band called London Beat with these three other guys. So how did that actually come about, and what were your feelings about the band at the beginning? Did you have real positive feelings about it working? Or did you feel like, oh, I wonder, you know, is this me trying again? And here we go again. Will this work? Do you know what I mean? Because you've been through such a lot of that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, once again, to paint the picture of where I was after Gonna Make You an Offer You Can't Refuse, I wanted to continue as a solo artist. That was my endeavor. That's what I wanted to be. And I knew in order to do that, I had to have songs. I did not have at that point in time my own, I didn't have enough confidence in my own songwriting or a mutual confidence, if you will, with the record company to say, I've got this song and that song and that song as a follow-up to Gonna Make You an Offer, or to maybe co-write something with John Worth, for example. None of that really came to be. None of it materialized quickly enough to sustain the success that we had with Make You an Offer, for example. So there I was, kind of back in the kind of hinterland, if you will, of what's going to happen next. What do I do now? I became a bit disillusioned by the atmosphere, the relationship with the record company that I was dealing with. And at that point, I went back to the U.S. I had family by that time, and I went back to the U.S., enrolled in a local community college, started taking some courses in computer programming and so forth to try and just get a new take on where I was. When I speak of computer programming, I was looking for some kind of programming that would, now there's loads of it. You've got all of these applications by which you can just load up in your home studio and make music on your own. You know, if I'd had something at my fingertips at that point in time, it may be that London Beat Mate would not have happened. But there you are. So after a time in the U.S., I started to look at my situation. I was getting fed up with computer programming. It was not what I wanted to be. I'm looking at the news and I see, bing, here's a band called Eurythmics who are on the front headline news on the Wall Street Journal about the return of the British music invasion to America, blah, blah, blah. That was the essence of this article. And I'm thinking, okay, so things are cooking back in the UK again, and it may be a time for me to get back there and get something done because it's music that I want to be. I've never denied that fact. So we sold house in Plymouth, Massachusetts, half an hour from Boston, and arrived back in the UK, bang, with nothing but a dream, empty pockets and a dream, if you will. I worked in computer programming to try and sort of, keep body and soul together whilst I got back into doing some session work, whatever it took to get connected back in the music scene in the UK. Long story short, Steve, a couple of friends that I had known prior to moving back to Boston had been working with Paul Young. They were out on tour with Paul Young, and they were trying to get me to go out on tour with Paul Young. But as I say, and I underline, now I don't want to be a BV singer. I don't want to be a background singer. I want to be a part of something that is ours, mine or ours. If you guys are interested in getting together, maybe we can write some songs. So what happens next? These two guys that I'm speaking of, George Chandler and Jimmy Chambers, and I were doing this television thing. I think it was The Wire, The Wired show, which came from Newcastle. We trained up to Newcastle, trained back home after it, you know.
Was that The Tube? The Tube.
Yeah, The Tube. Thank you. Yeah. It was The Tube. Thank you for the correction. It was not The Wire, it's The Tube. And so I ride back home. My phone rings minutes after I'm in the house. And this person is saying, hey, I just saw you guys on Tube. And we want to know if you're interested in getting together and writing some songs. That person was Willie M. and so, wow, you know, you think, well, okay, let's listen to it and see if there's anything in it. We met George, Jimmy, and I with William the following night in London, and the seeds were sown for London Beat from that meeting. And so it's amazing how, I don't know, you call it what you want. I call it some kind of a blessing, that we were able to be in that close proximity with each other. As I say, I just arrived back from Boston shortly before this, and here we are in a situation. I'm looking at this situation myself, and I'm thinking, is this what I want to be? We have to find out. Don't make any decisions until you've gone through the process and found out, satisfied yourself as to whether or not there's something in it worth pursuing. And it turned out that there was something pursuable in that.
Now, with the biggest hit, I've been thinking about you, which was a number one on the Billboard charts in America. I think it was number two in Britain. It was just all over the place. It's this massive, massive hit. But I think it came off the second album. So that, yes, and the first did. Album wasn't an immediate success, but the second album was. And I want to go back to a point where we met, because you were filming the video to I've Been Thinking About You. You may not even remember I was there, but I was. I remember it clearly because I loved it. And I was so shocked because there was this surprise, in a sense, and it felt like this video had to be done very quickly because the success of the song was so quick. And you were all taken by surprise, and you were all in this. There was this wonderful energy to it that day, and there was this wonderful feeling about it because it was such a beautiful, successful moment. And it felt like, you know, particularly for you, and I think for George and the other Jimmy, that it had taken a long, long time to get here. It had taken a long, long time to have this world success. How was that for you? And did it come as a surprise, or did you actually believe the moment you recorded it, we have something?
Well, we believed we had a song that yes, we had something with some strong possibilities as a single, follow-up single too. If I backtrack for a second, my favorite song of all the London Beat material we've ever done was 9 a.m. That song for me is represents something that is close to my heart and will remain so. That said, we got a lot of industry positive response from 9 a.m. And I think a lot of that flowed into what happened next. We went back when that first album, Speak, was finishing up, you know, and we'd gotten as much mileage out of it as we could. Time to do a second album. And we were speaking with the record company, and they're saying, you know, you need to come more kind of into some middle ground that's radio friendly and blah, blah, blah. All of that business that record companies, rightfully, I guess, put to their artists. Some of it's questionable in hindsight, but there you are. We went back in and started the second album with a view to, trying to come more mainstream, if you will, and get something that had more radio friendliness about it. I've Been Thinking About You happened. It was a surprise. It was a case of everybody standing up to the microphone, singing their bit of what they thought this track could sound like. Jimmy Chambers stood up to the microphone and sang almost top to bottom what we now know as that song, I've Been Thinking About You. And we looked at each other all and we thought, maybe we got something here. Let's pursue this. We finished what we thought was the best demo we could of I've Been Thinking About You, sent it back to BMG, and they listened to it and said, try again. Try and see if you can push this idea into something more something, whatever. What it sounded like to us was the record company was looking for us to write our first swimming pool, if you will, to write your first mansion off this song, you know, and it's a mistake because you're reaching for something that is not in your heart and not in your soul and so forth. So long story, maybe short as possible. We pursued the original idea of I've Been Thinking About You, pushed it around and came back time and time again after maybe 50, 60 tries, came back to the original idea. We embellished the mix as much as we could, sent it back to the record company, and they said, okay, this is it. Basically the same. It's like if it's like somebody served you a meal and you say, no, send it back to the kitchen. The kitchen sends it back, and they put a couple more lettuce leaves on the plate or something. You know,
you know what it's like, Jimmy. It's like what William Goldman said about the film industry. No one knows anything.
So. It's true. It's so true. No business is that more true than in the music business. It is what it is. And in hindsight, you know, it's all, you can put it down to a lesson learned here and there. But in the final analysis, it's a lesson about the artist trusting their own integrity, trusting their own instincts. And because you're always going to come back to those anyway. If you don't come back to those in the final analysis, you're going to be sorry that you didn't, because you ended up maybe selling your soul in some way that you didn't want to do. So, yeah.
Beautifully. I want to just go back to something you mentioned, because it's made me curious. This 9 a.m., I mean, that was much more of a soulful song. What was it about? What was close to you about that song? Can you tell me? Because you said it was very personal.
It happened, maybe, it was probably the second song, that second song idea that we worked on. And the whole situation under which 9 a.m. came to be was that William, Jimmy, George, and I had met, I think maybe the second time we met ever. To backtrack to the story that I told you about how we met in the first place with William, we were kicking around this thing, and Willie handed me a cassette, really worn out cassette, and he said, "Take this home. There's a couple of those scratchy ideas on here that maybe we can look at next time if we meet our next time." So I took it home, shoved it into the cassette player, and this scratchy little thing was coming back at me off the cassette, which was the basis of the chord structure, excuse me, and the atmosphere, if you will, that became 9 a.m. I got on the phone, rang Willie, and said, if you got anything you can bring tomorrow to move this idea on structurally, chord wise, whatever, bring it, because I think maybe there's something here. I said to him, I remember this, we might have a song here for Tina Turner. That was my, at that point in time, London Beat was not yet an entity. We were just some guys getting together to write songs. And with that in mind, I'm thinking, well, if this is an idea, who could we give it to? London Beat was just a twinkle in our eye at that point. You know, we were songwriters together at that point. So we together the next night, the next time we met, we pushed this idea into what became the 90% basis of 9 a.m. It's a wonderful story with this song, because the strings and everything was an idea that struck from the man who had done the strings for a lot of the Eurythmics material. Here comes the rain again. If you listen to that track and listen to the strings, the man who did the string arrangements for that is the same guy. So all of these little stories make for something very precious for me when it comes to certain of our titles, and 9 a.m. being the precious one for me.
I remember an evening after that massive success, and I think it was Willie Emery. This is pretty vague because there was a lot of alcohol involved in this night, and a couple of buses.
Yeah,
and oh, I think buses, yeah. Do you remember? Yeah, what there was a London Beat party on two sort of coaches or bus London buses. Yeah, there was two London buses, and I need to sort of explain this a little bit to everyone, but it was organised that we went to different people's homes where a party mm-hmm. was already set up. We would go in, the music would go on, we'd have a little party for, I don't know, half an hour, a klaxon would go off, we'd have to go back on the bus, and then we'd go off. And we ended up also at the Limelight, and the last place we ended up was some Italian restaurant, I think, which had opened kindly for us to serve us all espressos in the early hours. But this was one of the greatest parties I'd been on in my life, because it was such a lot of fun.
Oh, wonderful.
Were you there?
I was there.
I can't remember much about it. I'm sorry.
Once again, a tiny bit of backstory about how that idea of doing this bus party thing happened in the first place. We were in, Monte Carlo, somewhere doing a television, and they transported us from our hotel to a place where they were having, you know, the record company was having a party for us in this restaurant. And in this restaurant, we had a great time. We were there any number of times when we were in that neck of the woods. But in this restaurant, the musicians they had these roving musicians who would come around to your table, and we were laughing by the fact because as the music sped up, your eating process got faster and faster. The faster the music got, the faster you ate. You know? So we were throwing these ideas around about what, because if you remember, maybe not because we were drinking so much that night at this party you're speaking of, Sandra Turnbull, William, and I were all Librans. We were born all close around the same point in time in late September, early October. And so we decided we were going to have this party to celebrate our combined birthday, if you will, you know, and a lot of things, a lot of other things at the same time. So I can't remember. I think Willie and Sandra and I collaborated about how we're going to do this thing, and somebody said we could do it on a city bus in London, but how are you going to do that? So it boiled down to two buses stopping at all these places, a shot of tequila or tin in this place, and then maybe a couple more and a beer to top it off. And so we ended up in this Italian restaurant. It was an amazing night. It was an amazing night. We're still talking about it.
It was genius. It really was genius. Another thing that happened as well, I believe I trained, this is inverted commas, all of you as an interview trainer one evening.
You did?
Yeah. Have no idea why, because talking to you today, there was never any reason to be to have to train London. No, you were all such good talkers. You were always such good talkers. But that was another really special occasion. That was at Willie M's flat, wasn't it? I think we went there.
Yep. I think if memory serves, you were doing some things for MTV.
Yeah, that's right. I was presenting on MTV and interviewing people, and I think the record company then phoned me up and said, would you like to do some interview training with London Beat? And I was like, yep.
Absolutely. Fantastic.
And it was fantastic.
Sandra was very good at many things, managerial duties, if you will. But she was very good at spotting what needed to be done, what we needed to look like on stage, how we're gonna, ideas for the next video, all of these things, which quite honestly, as an artist, I had not ventured into. I didn't feel like it was my territory to start doing input for, you see? But Sandra encouraged us to bring our ideas forth and inject our own feelings about this, that, or other aspect of what we were doing as a band. And one of those things was to get on board somebody who could give us some instruction, give us some ideas about how to respond in an interview situation and not waffle. I remember using that. Don't waffle.
I think I said that. I think the thing was, you were a group of four people, and a group is always much more difficult when a question is given to a group. It's easier on a one-to-one interview basis for the person to answer, because then they know they're the one answering. But when it's a group, everyone wants to get their piece in, and it's actually sort of paying respect to each other. Anyhow, I'm not going to give you a lesson again, because this is ridiculous. But what I want to say, it really pleases me that London Beat, or that today, New London Beat, which is without Willie M today, mm-hmm. yes. And you are still performing, and you're out there, and you're still singing. Can you tell me how it is for you today to be still, and if I can say it, you know, you're over 80 and you're yes. performing on stage, and you have a wonderful energy and charisma and power still today. I mean, you always Thank had you. It, but you really have it today, and that pleases me so immensely. So how is it for you to be out there touring and playing, still playing gigs?
I can sum it up, I think, in a couple of words. At my age, I get up every day, every morning. I go to bed at night. And the first thing I hear in the morning and the last thing I hear at night is the old man knocking at the door. I've worked out the way that I ain't going to let him in. Okay? Boom. And that's once... I've made that conclusion. The rest, it simplifies the process. For if you make that decision that, yeah, you get older, but you don't have to get old. You know, you age, but you don't have to. I'm not ready for the walking stick quite yet. So if when it happens, I'll embrace that part of my life. But for now, the energy is still good. I think the blessing is, as I look around at the period in time that we had our success with London Beat, and I look at other artists that I can compare our, not necessarily the level of success, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about how you are perceived as time has gone on, how your music has stood or not stood the test of time. And one thing that stands out for me as an example is I was looking, I'm an avid news reader, and especially in the music scene. After all of these years, Rolling Stone magazine, you know, Rolling Stone, has decided this year that Marvin Gaye should be in the top five of most important singers of our time, of our generation and preceding generation, etc. So for that to happen now, how long has Marvin Gaye not been with us? And you look at that, and I look at it myself, and I say, there's a perception here of this music is being perceived now to have elevated itself from the time when it was originally recorded and performed. Marvin Gaye has been gone a long time, but his stature in the music business has elevated itself in a way that makes me think, yeah, there's something about longevity that is a blessing. And for as long as I can embrace that, keeping the old man outside the door, I'm going to do it. I'm going to keep doing it, Steve.
Brilliant. Well, I hope that longevity goes for a very, very long time, because one thing I want to say to you is that I really appreciate your talent and your voice and how it's enriched our culture and enriched my life. And it is an absolutely beautiful, beautiful voice. So, Jimmy Helms, thank you from the bottom of my heart. It was so lovely to see you again. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And as they say, it ain't over till the fat lady sings. And I ain't hearing her sing yet. So there's more music coming. And fingers crossed, when it's ready, I'll squirt something across to you and see what you think of it. But it's been an absolute joy speaking to you. And all the wonderful golden memories of those times of flooding back. But let's push it on and see what happens in the future.
Great, Jimmy. And I'm going to come and see you in concert whenever I've got the opportunity. So thank you, and I'll see you again. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, I'm going to... how do I do this? I'm going to turn the recording off, and I think I end it at the same time. Jimmy, thanks so much. And thanks to Emma as well for arranging it. And hopefully we'll speak again in the future.
Thank you from Emma. She's dying to see this. I know she's
such a... I'll send her a copy. Please, of the whole thing. You can use it. Yeah? All right. Brilliant.
Wonderful. Bye, Jim. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.